25. There'd been some controversy in the meantime because the initial investigation design included a lot of conflicts of interest for city officials who had been involved in some of the like backroom dealings with Zenith, were given the responsibility of doing the investigation. And so advocates, including Breach and others, and then also councilors Green and Murillo, you know, put the mayor on notice that that was bad and that we shouldn't have poorly designed investigations with conflicts of interest, because that's unlikely to lead to accountability. And so around in the fall, the mayor announced that they were going to hire independent investigators. And so I think a lot of people were like, okay, that's a good sign that we're going to have some kind of like, you know, decent investigation here. But it turns out the investigation wasn't very good. The conflicts of interest were never solved. The same city staff were allowed to conduct the initial investigation, which resulted in a really narrow scope. It resulted in ignoring a bunch of really important acts that Zenith had done, and had really bad conclusions. And so, and the outside counsel that was supposed to support it really didn't have a very large role. They were sort of just reviewing the staff's investigation. So we were mad about that, and it took a long time to read through all their documentation, but we put this letter together. Breach and several other organizations, Portland Harbor Community Coalition, 350PDX, Braid River Campaign, many others, sent this letter rejecting the investigation, both in terms of the who did it and its conclusions, and chastising the mayor for his poor behavior.
Can we talk a little bit more specifically about what those issues were that you and the coalition found with this investigation? Can you speak more specifically to these aspects of, you know, the conflict of interest, the scope, and, you know, the limited ways in which this investigation did what it was supposed to according to the resolution that council passed?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll bring us back to last March to build that context so it's really clear the problems that we have. So last March, the city passed a resolution that called on the mayor to do a bunch of different investigations. And the reason why that Zenith accountability resolution was so important was we just saw a bunch of very outrageous behavior from city staff leading up to it. So folks might remember that in the fall of 2024, Zenith got this huge $372,000 fine for illegally constructing piping. And as a part of that, the Department of Environmental Quality forced the city to like consider its authorizations for Zenith again. So there was a new land use compatibility statement process. We also had investigative reporting showing that Zenith was planning to expand into a regional renewable fuels hub, putting Portlanders at much greater risk, even than they are now, from trains and from earthquake. And then we saw the city staff basically pretending that they didn't know about that when they clearly did through public records. We saw city administrator Donnie Oliveira repeatedly providing inaccurate information to city council. We saw a city attorney trying to hide information from the public and labeling things as attorney-client privilege improperly. And then we saw, while the city was asking, while the city council was asking the staff and the mayor to slow down so we could think this stuff through, we saw them rush a land use compatibility statement authorization for Zenith, basically against the wishes of city council and a huge tide of public opposition. So that was like a lot of really messed up stuff happening in a short amount of time. And that was the backdrop for why they asked for these investigations in the first place. We had the same city staff that were implicated in all the things I just mentioned being charged with investigating Zenith, which essentially meant investigating themselves and their own reputations, that's what the conflict of interest is. Anybody who's ever been on a board or had any experience with conflicts of interest can see that very clearly. So that was never solved for. The same staff conducted the investigation. And then they omitted really important things, items and actions from Zenith from the analysis. So Zenith came to town around 2017, 2018, misled state and city regulators over and over about what they were doing, about they told Mayor Wheeler that they were going to get rid of tar sands when they weren't. They told DEQ that this new infrastructure that they were putting in would never result in increased volume of oil coming through the community. That was false. And a variety of other acts that they performed. They broke lobbying law in 2022. So the staff just didn't consider any of those things, like clear instances of fraud and deceit that Zenith had done in the past. And then they improperly understood the language of the franchise agreement as well and improperly applied it. They basically took everything and narrowed it and excluded things so that they couldn't possibly find any violations of the franchise agreement. And for a company that has been found to violate the law as many times as Zenith has over the years, that they didn't find one violation of the franchise agreement is pretty astounding. So I can go into more detail if you like, but that the major problems that we had with the investigation. We think it was designed to fail from the beginning, that they just didn't look where they didn't want to find places where they'd have to make a finding of illegality.
And for clarity's sake, if they had found violations of the franchise agreement, what would that have allowed the city to do?
If they found violations of the franchise agreement, then they'd be allowed to take action under the franchise agreement. And just to kind of give you an idea of this circular logic on display and how silly this is. So the city has known about a lot of these franchise violations for a long time because, you know, they've been paying attention to the state regulators fining Zenith and stuff, and they haven't enforced the franchise agreement to date, which is a problem. But the language of the franchise agreement says just because the city hasn't yet enforced these provisions does not mean that they waive them. So they could go back and enforce this all the way back to the time when Zenith first came if they wanted to. And instead of doing that and starting to investigate those things and make findings around that, they used the evidence that the city has never enforced the franchise agreement as a reason that they now shouldn't enforce the franchise agreement. So like really, really bizarre circular logic to avoid taking any steps at all.
What is the impact that you hope this letter will have?
At a like immediate stage, it's just important that we don't allow this type of neglect and bad behavior to occur without the community speaking on it. I think it's just really important to point out when people are asked to do accountability work and they refuse to do it, that needs to be a part of the public record. So making sure that the public understands what happened and that the mayor knows that we're watching is important, because at some point he's accountable to the public through elections and other means, and public information is really important. And then also, you know, Zenith is still here. They're trying to sell their facility right now to this hedge fund called I Squared Capital, another faceless energy company. And, you know, they're probably going to try to get the same deal that Zenith has, where they assume the city's never going to enforce any rules against them, right? That's probably what they're purchasing this facility for. We need to set some kind of precedent that fossil fuel companies just can't walk into Portland, break the law repeatedly, step all over everybody, threaten, cajole, break lobbying laws, you know, threaten lawsuits whenever they want to, and get the result of getting a hands-off approach from the city. That's just got to end. And, you know, shining a light on the poor behavior from the city so far is important. And then making sure that our city council sees that we care about this so they can actually change the laws and prevent this from happening in the future.
That leads into my next question. Are there other legal avenues, either for the city, for the city council, or for the community here, when it comes to Zenith and their violations, as you've mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, the city council absolutely could tell the mayor to go back and do the investigation better, or spend money hiring a fully outside investigator. That's one thing that they could do. It's something that now Council President Jamie Dunphy said that he was open to back in September. And, you know, perhaps that's still the same position there. And so they could continue doing oversight. They could also hold the line when city staff ask for the city council to just give I-Squared Capital the same franchise agreement that Zenith has right now, which is likely to happen soon. There's supposed to be a public process around that. That could be an opportunity for the council to intervene. And then we've also got this big critical energy infrastructure hub policy process that started last March that's been going, you know, for a year now through the Planning Commission that will be coming to City Council soon. And a lot of Zenith's bad acts and plans for expansion are implicated in this new policy proposal. So the city could, you know, stop the expansion of that facility by adopting this CEI hub policy process as well. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and it's a little bit complicated, but there are maybe a handful of opportunities in the next 6 months where our city council could really lean in and win big for the community and make things a lot safer.
Since this, I mean, the investigation, the pushing city council to get an investigation going was a big part of the 2024 campaigns for a lot of councilors. It was a big push early in the new city government system, seen as a big victory that this was finally able to come through. And then as the investigation happened, it seemed like things kind of went quiet for a while. Is it your sense that this is still a pressing issue for Portlanders?
It's definitely a pressing interest for Portlanders. There is a large, organized, motivated, and mobilized climate justice and safety community. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a really large press conference at St. Augustina Lutheran Church, where many, many neighborhood associations and coalitions showed up to show their support for strong city policy. So we've seen these signs over and over and over again that the community remains mobilized and committed to a safer critical energy infrastructure hub. And every time we see any kind of public process around Zenith or any new news, it's big news in the community because people really care and they want to see that accountability. You know, I've seen polling on this issue not too long ago that showed a really good percentage of Portlanders care about Zenith, want to see accountability there. So in my mind, we're the clear majority here. There's no question about that. And I believe that the city council, I think like 8 or 9 of the city councilors have this as a pretty high priority. And when they hear from advocacy organizations, neighborhood coalitions and associations and their residents, they want to see action. So far, they've done a pretty good job of responding to that. And I expect that because it's such an important issue that if we apply the right pressure and speak on it and ask them to take action, that they will.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, as disappointed as we are in the mayor right now, I think on the whole, we're still building a lot of momentum for big things right now. So now is the time to get active. We're about to experience a massive energy crisis because of the Trump administration's illegal war in Iran, and the time to transition to renewable. The best time to do it was, you know, many years ago. The next best time to speed a rapid transition to renewable energy and electrification is now. And so we have to fight and demand the future that we want. Now is the time.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Always happy to.
That was Nick Caleb, climate and energy attorney with Breach Collective, speaking with me about a letter to Mayor Wilson rejecting the results of the Zenith Energy investigation. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On his very first day in office, President Donald Trump signed an executive order denying U.S. citizenship to babies born to undocumented parents and lawful but temporary residents, such as students, several categories of workers from abroad, and tourists. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on April 1st challenging the ban, and they're expected to issue a ruling in June. Left out of his rationale for the ban are the long-term economic consequences, potentially in the trillions, of shrinking the American-born workforce and the generational hit to the pipeline of workers the country will desperately need. That's doctors, nurses, and caregivers for America's rapidly aging population. Also ignored are the ramifications of creating an underclass of children born in the U.S. but without status, essentially stateless. 7 states are currently considering legislation which would ban unauthorized children from attending public schools.
Such legislation challenges a 1982 Supreme Court ruling, which guarantees a free public school education to all children, regardless of immigration status. Sunita Sarabji of American Community Media convened a panel of experts to examine these unintended consequences of a ban on birthright citizenship.
Let's begin with Dr. Philip Connor, who will discuss the multi-trillion dollar hit to the U.S. economy if the ban on birthright citizenship is upheld by the Supreme Court. Welcome, Dr. Connor.
Hi, Sunita. Really glad to be here today. Thank you, everyone, for joining. I am Philip Connor. I'm at Princeton University at the Center for Migration and Development. And I want to share with you an economic study that I and other colleagues put together in advance of the oral arguments. It was released a couple weeks ago, prior to the oral arguments. My co-authors, Matthew Hall at Cornell University, as well as Francesc Ortega at Notre Dame University, want to recognize them as part of this project. And this project was organized through the cooperation of the Center for Migration Studies, and it was published in the Journal on Migration and Human Security. So as we've already heard from the professor, we have seen of how this is a first and foremost a legal case, this question before us as this executive order has been taken to the Supreme Court. But I and my colleagues wanted to get a sense of the economic impact, or at least the economic accounting of birthright citizenship beneficiaries in the past and currently and into the future. We know that much social scientific research have looked at the benefits of immigrant children having U.S. citizenship and how they've been able to break a number of generational barriers in terms of their economic position, in terms of mobility, in terms of career. But we wanted to give a sense of putting some numbers around that, those contributions that birthright citizenship beneficiaries have given over the past several years. Now, our approach is to lean on existing U.S. Census Bureau data, surveys that many of you have probably filled out over the years, like the American Community Survey that may have come to your home, or maybe you were called for the current population survey, the one that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses typically for measuring unemployment rates. We rely on those data, and I'm not going to get into the methods, but allows us to basically identify those in that survey that likely benefited from U.S. citizenship at birth to two undocumented parents or two temporary immigrants living in the United States. There's a lot of hurdles to be able to obtain those identifications of people within the data, but we went through some very conventional as well as innovative methods to be able to do that. And so I wanted to state here that these estimates are conservative. Why? Because we are leaning on the fact that those two undocumented parents or two temporary migrant parents are still alive today and are living in the United States. And so therefore, we are missing out on many people that could have benefited from birthright citizenship in many ways. Maybe they used to live in the United States, maybe they were born in the United States, but now have since moved to another country. Maybe their parents are no longer living. Maybe they are no longer living. Maybe they were born to an undocumented single parent that we don't know the immigration status of the other parents. So there's a lot of people here that could be missing. And for that reason, I want to emphasize that this economic accounting is conservative. In fact, it could be as much as double or more than what I'm going to share with you today. So we identified in these surveys of individuals born since 1960 and born through to what we expect to 2045 to number at least as 4 million beneficiaries. Again, very conservative. It's likely could be as many as double depending on the assumptions that you put within the data. Now, we found that these people live across the United States, but earlier adults that are currently in the workforce primarily live in three states, California, Florida, and Texas. But as migration patterns have changed over the years, we've been able to see of how it's far more distributed in terms of U.S. citizen beneficiaries to two undocumented or temporary immigrant parents have encountered all across the United States. Now, looking at these data, we're able to lean on the fact that we know what the adults that are currently in the workforce, of what their beneficiary kind of status is as U.S. citizens born in the United States to two undocumented or temporary migrant parents. We lean on their educational experience, we lean on their labor force participation, on their occupations to predict what may be occurring among those into the future, those that are currently children and benefiting from birthright citizenship, and including those yet to be born and would benefit from birthright citizenship in the next couple decades or so.
So we next go to Dr. Gellert from the Migration Policy Institute. Dr. Gellert, welcome.
Thank you so much, Sunita, and it's nice to be with all of you today, talking about this really important topic. At the Migration Policy Institute, we looked at this question in a little bit of a different way, looking at some of the demographic impacts of ending birthright citizenship, as President Trump has attempted to do. And this is work that I did with my colleague Michael Fix and also with MPI non-resident fellow Jennifer Van Hook, who's at Pennsylvania State University. We started with the understanding that the goal of President Trump's executive order was to reduce illegal immigration and to reduce the size, therefore, of the unauthorized immigrant population. But we find, in fact, that the executive order would do quite the opposite. Because children would be born in the United States without legal status if they didn't have birthright citizenship, the unauthorized immigrant population would actually grow by 2.7 million more over the next 20 years and 5.4 million more over 50 years compared to what we would see if current interpretations of the 14th Amendment were to continue. This reflects our estimate of the number of children who would be born to unauthorized immigrants or temporary workers in the United States without citizenship or legal status and would live out their lives in the United States. And importantly, it includes children over this 50-year time span. It includes children born to today's unauthorized immigrants and even the grandchildren of today's unauthorized immigrants who might be excluded from legal status if there were no pathway for people born here without status to find their way to status. Looking at the numbers a different way, we estimate that about 255,000 children on average each year would start their lives in the United States without status. Some might choose to leave the United States, some might find their way onto legal status, but they would at least have that early experience of not having legal status. The broader reality of this is that repealing birthright citizenship would create a self-perpetuating class excluded from social membership. This would span across generations. Some of this has been mentioned, but just to kind of put everything together, this means that kids would be growing up in the United States without access to Medicaid, to food assistance, to other public benefits. When they experience times of need and hardship, they wouldn't have that government safety net below them. They would, as Dr. Connor mentioned, they would have constrained access to higher education. Unauthorized immigrants are excluded from federal financial aid and often from state financial aid in some states. And we're seeing a movement on this policy topic at the state level. In some states, unauthorized immigrant kids have to pay out-of-state tuition to attend college. And more importantly, they would grow up knowing that they aren't able to work legally in the United States. This would lead to lower educational aspirations, because what is the value of striving towards a college degree or a graduate degree if you can't use it to work in a professional job? We have seen the converse of this in the United States with the DACA program. A cohort of unauthorized immigrant youth were given access to work authorization and protections from deportation. And what all of the research has shown was that led to higher high school graduation rates, higher college enrollment rates, higher college completion rates, more employment and higher paying professional jobs. So we know that having that access to work authorization and to some at least tenuous claim on belonging helps people to aspire to higher achievement and to achieve higher incomes and more economic stability. Furthermore, if we didn't have birthright citizenship, the US would be maintaining a growing population that has no voice in our political system and has a tentative sense of their belonging in the country. The US has, compared to other countries around the world, had an exemplary record of immigrant integration across generations, where the children of immigrants far surpass their parents' success. Repealing birthright citizenship threatens to really harm and jeopardize that record that we've had.
Well, thank you. Zhao will discuss the potential shortages of highly skilled talent from abroad who may choose to immigrate to other countries with stable paths for their yet-to-be-born children. He will also focus on the shortage of professionals at rural hospitals and nursing home staff, which are already facing shortages of staffing due to changes in the H-1B rules. Welcome, Zhao.
Thank you for having me, Sydney. I'm really glad to have a moment to talk about this because, you know, when we talk about birthright citizenship and in the news, you know, the chatter and conversation has always been around, so what's the constitutional doctrine? What does the Constitution say? What is a court case? What is legal theory? And those matter for the sake of the challenges that are going on and the legal arguments, but they miss the side of the debate that I feel it doesn't get enough attention that has long-term consequences or impacts to the country, which is this is the side that shows up in hospital staffing, in research lab staffing, and really about what happened years prior around those family dinner tables. So a ban on birthright citizenship is not just about changing the legal rule. It changes how talented people around the world think about building a life in the United States. And the talking point is around eliminating birth tourism, which is a near-term and in-time issue, but it significantly damaged consequences in the long run, which is if you're a highly skilled worker, whether it's in technology, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's any other field, and you're deciding where to build your future and your family's future, you're not just looking at the salary or title or the organization, you're asking the bigger question around, like, can I build a stable life in that place, right? Can I raise my family there? Will my children be secure there? And these questions matter, especially in places that are already struggling to attract and retain talent, including our rural communities across the country. And for many families, the message from this executive order on birthright citizenship is that even if you come legally, right, even if you work hard, even if you do exactly what America asks of you in this process, your children's future here may still be uncertain. And so focusing on just rural healthcare as a spotlight for a moment, the Association of American Medical Colleges project that United States could face a physician shortage of up to 86,000 doctors by 2036. At the same time, immigrants account for over a quarter of all physicians working in US hospitals. And the shortage is even more urgent and prevalent in rural America, where a analysis in 2025 found that immigrants make up of only 5% of the overall rural workforce, but 14% of physicians and surgeons in rural America. And that's almost three times their share. So if you think about what those consequences mean, if you have a modest amount of international physicians, nurses, and other clinicians and healthcare workers decide that America is becoming too unstable of a place to raise their family, and the first places to feel it will not necessarily be the wealthy urban hospital systems, but there'll be these rural hospitals already struggling to recruit. And it will be these nursing homes that can't find enough aides and the long-term care providers, right, deciding if they can safely staff another set of beds or wings. And it's these older Americans, disabled Americans, families in small towns and rural communities who will bear the largest burden of longer wait times, fewer providers, and more fragile care. And these changes may feel long-term, but we are also, this administration, simultaneously hurting the short-term with the recent $100,000 fee attached to H-1B applications from abroad, which is one of the primary pathways for foreign doctors to come and practice in the United States. And unless this new bipartisan exemption bill passes soon, we are already seeing in rural California, as an example, clinics pausing on hiring dozens of desperately needed doctors because of their inability to afford this high upfront fee. And so when I take a step back and think about this issue as a whole, it should be framed outside of what the 14th Amendment says or doesn't say, or what like subject to the jurisdiction thereof means. It's a debate about what kind of message America is trying to send to the rest of the world. And the truth is that the birthright citizenship has long done more than just confer legal status. It's offered clarity, right? It's told families that if your child is born here, your child can belong here. If you're here, your child can stay here. And that clarity matters because it reduces fear. It allows people to plan with confidence.
That was an American Community Media panel hosted by Sunita Sarabji on the unintended consequences of a ban on birthright citizenship. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us. Stay tuned. Labor Radio is next.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Did you catch the Bluegrass Marathon? If you enjoyed the programming, you can show your support for KBOO and music from the True Vine by purchasing a